it's all being recorded.
It is, yeah.
Awesome. So that brings us on to the news. It doesn't really, of course. Should we make a start?
Yeah.
Yeah, we might as well, eh? Hello everybody. Happy Monday. Is it Monday?
Yeah, it will be Monday.
It will one day be Monday.
The new podcast day.
It's a new day. It's a new dawn. It's a new podcast. And we're feeling good. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
And collectively, we welcome you with one single voice, with a thousand hearts, to podcast series 5, episode 2 of the Tux Radar podcast.
Awesome.
But we always just say the podcast.
The podcast.
That's like in... That's bad SEO. I know SEO doesn't work in recorded sound and that, but we should say Tux Radar podcast more often. Tux Radar Pod brought to you by Linux Format.
Yes.
It does. So intro, people. In this episode, we have news. We have discoveries of... Oh, bugger. We have discoveries of the week. We have halfway reminder. We've got a challenge.
Awesome.
We are changing the podcast based... Maybe 70% based on feedback that we got from you, dear listeners, last fortnight, and there's an open ballot, and there's maybe one last thing. Subscribe. You can subscribe to Linux Format, which is the magazine that we produce, at tinyurl.com/LXFOffer1. And we're also now available to buy on Google Play.
Can I just say a massive thank you to everybody?
We have an average,
You say it.
Yeah. An average rating, reviews, of 4.4 out of 5, which is...
All thanks to you, which is... It's just fantastic. It really makes us feel good, and it also helps to keep the bureaucrats off our back. So, really, can't thank you enough.
So that brings us on to the news. And the first item, KDE 4.10, has been released. If you're a member of a boy band listening to this and you don't know what KDE is, it's a desktop environment for Linux. You should check it out.
And it's cool, more importantly.
It's cool.
That's what boy bands like.
Yeah. Apparently. Graham, you're our resident KDE user.
Every time there's a new KDE release, it's Graham, you're our resident KDE user. It's not your fault, Ben. Before you, it was John, and before John, it was Mike. Graham, you're our resident KDE user. What do you think of the new... I haven't a clue. I haven't installed it.
All right, Graham, you're our resident boy band listener. What would you like to let the huddled masses of boy bands know about KDE?
I actually think Justin Bieber's new video for Beauty and the Beat is strangely addictive. It's really good. I really like the way it's done. As for KDE 4.10, who knows?
I have a KDE related point. The semantic desktop thing, social thing, where you never learn where your files are, you just search for them, so you don't need to bother with having an organized file system and that. It hasn't really worked so far, because it takes so long to index. If you've got lots and lots of files, it takes a long time.
Gigabytes of spare hard drive space.
Well, yes, but they, for KDE 4.10, 4.10, they seem to have fixed a lot of this, because Nepomuk, is it Nepomuk?
Yes, it is.
Nepomuk, the thing that does that thing, it now indexes once, and then finds out what type of files things are, and then goes back and then indexes through the files that it's actually likely to be the thing that you're looking for.
Right.
So rather than, if you search for an MP3, rather than like going into the metadata of all of your video files and all of your documents and stuff, it will just identify the MP3s first and then search within the MP3s. So yeah, it's amazing that it wasn't doing that before.
Yes, it's a pretty woeful service, actually. Yeah. I often kill it. and try and kill Nepomuk and the... anyway.
So when you want to find an MP3, how do you do it?
I go to my MP3 folder.
Oh, wow. That's elite.
That's amazing. In fact, all my albums, they're all sorted by albums and into artists and also into these weird Graham categories that I have, such as ambient and assemblage. I know where everything is.
This is what makes you a resident KDE user.
I will say that I know that a lot of work has gone into this version of KDE to make QML and Qt Quick a big part of it, which should mean that lots of parts of the desktop are much easier to develop for third parties and plugins. And QML, the Qt's kind of rapid development framework, is an excellent tool. And the fact that that's been brought into Plasma even more closely could only be a good thing, I guess.
So I guess our takeaway thing about KDE 4.10 is that if you're a boy band member and you want to find your songs in your computer, yes, you can now do it quicker.
Although surely they have them littered across their desktop, which would confuse them in KDE because they can't just drag and drop them. Under their desktop.
So,
how are you going to linkly put the boy band meme?
I haven't got a clue. KDE is a desktop environment that's popular with boy bands. Now, boy bands like their gadgets, they like to look cool. And what is cooler than a Linux running phone? Now, funny I should mention Linux running phones. Ubuntu have just announced that they're hoping to ship their first phones in October.
That is great news.
Excellent news.
So I know that when they announced the phones back in January, the big thing we all said is, well, you know, we can all talk about releasing phones. It's when we actually get the hardware that we'll care about it. And now apparently they've got the hardware.
Are we going to get one to review?
Oh, I doubt it.
Yeah. Andrew, when you've left us and worked for Canonical, will you send us a phone?
No, I'll be too busy stuffing my face with mini burgers. Getting obscenely fat and going to the Tate Modern in my lunch hour.
Yeah.
We will, of course, try very hard to get a phone by emailing people at Canonical. Like Nick Veitch.
John O'Bacon.
Yes, John O'Bacon. It is great. It's fun. It'll be out in October, so we'll be able to give it a proper try. As I said before, the videos look really cool. I'm excited by it.
Yeah. So, from one piece of hardware that works under Linux to another piece that doesn't. Some Samsung laptops have basically started bricking when you try and install Linux on them. It appears to be a bug in the UEFI code, whatever UEFI is. I guess it's some code. And just sort of stops booting if you try and install Linux. Should point out that Samsung have been working with some Linux guys to try and fix this, so they haven't just pushed it out and gone, "Wow, rubbish, it's designed for Windows." And there has been a fix released, although the rumours on the interweb is that the fix isn't working. So if you have a Samsung laptop, it's probably best not to try and install Linux on it just yet.
But it wasn't it just particularly for Ubuntu? If you tried to install Ubuntu on them?
It initially was noticed under Ubuntu, but I believe it was Linux in general.
Right.
But, well, obviously not all Linux will boot UEFI. So yeah, watch out.
Starting to hear quite a few difficult stories actually about dealing with UEFI and the BIOS replacement. I know that our friends over at PC Format, they're trying to get Linux working and getting on the Steam kind of bandwagon. And Dave James lost all of his data from trying to install Ubuntu on a UEFI computer. I also sent a PDF to someone of the UEFI piece that was in the last issue, whose company was also starting to encounter difficulty with dealing with UEFI issues as they start to roll out enterprise versions of Linux on new hardware.
I was chatting to a guy from Zareason, the Linux hardware company, about it, and they test out loads of motherboards, and I asked them, you know, have they come across any issues, and they said no.
Mm.
They were all working, obviously, other than the really annoying Microsoft key issue that was known about. They said it's all working as expected up until now. I guess the issue is it's so new that...
There's different implementations of it.
Yeah.
But what I read was that in some cases actually stopped the hardware from working completely. Does that mean that do you have to install Windows 8 or
no, I mean, the reason, whatever. Well, from what I've heard, it's bricking. Phrase bricking means it turns it into a brick.
And that's it. It just does not. It just does not work at all.
I mean, you can use it to build a house with if you get enough of them, but that's about the only purpose of it. Brilliant. So, yeah, it can't even go back to Windows.
A big bad wolf would take many, many puffs to blow down a house made of Samsung laptops. Yeah. It's probably not a bad choice.
Yeah. So, moving back to another piece of hardware that does work with Linux, Raspberry Pi Model A's have gone on sale. Woo!
Excellent. All power to the Raspberry Pi Foundation.
Yeah.
Are these the super duper cheap ones?
These are the super duper cheap ones. They're, how much are they? $25, is that right?
Yeah, I think $25. It works out about £18.
Yeah.
So what is the difference in the hardware?
The difference is they've only got one USB port and they've got no Ethernet port and they've got a little less RAM.
Right.
They've got the amount of RAM that the Raspberry Pi Model B was supposed to initially have before it got more.
Is that 256 RAMs?
Yes, 256.
So what's it, Wi-Fi only?
No,
nothing. They've not got no network connection.
A single USB port or not use at all.
Yeah. And yeah, performance through the USB ports has always been an issue on the Raspberry Pis because the amount they bundle through it. So yeah, you ain't going to get quick connection. So generally, if you need network connection, get the Model B.
Smash
the extra tenner.
I really hope they do well. I don't quite see the reasoning behind releasing the Model A now.
It was all part of the initial plan. Yes, they had to release it now, otherwise it'd be like, why haven't they done it? I mean, I think the biggest thing for it's going to be in robotics and that sort of thing, where the lower power draw, this is, I think they report about 300 milliamps.
And the thing is, you can develop whatever you're developing on a Model B, and then if you want to roll it out to 100 different robots, you know, just fill them with Model A's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still cool.
Yeah, because it's hard to see them as being that useful for anything else. The actual desktop thing, you're missing so much by only having the one. Because the thing is, by the time you bought one of these and a USB hub so you can plug in your keyboard and your mouse, it's the same price.
£7.
It's basically the same price as a Model B.
Yeah.
So, it's a great little piece of kit and for certain applications.
Yeah. I can't believe we're complaining at all about a £17 Linux computer, but there you go.
Yeah, and in more Raspberry Pi related news, Google have paid for 15,000 of the Raspberry Pis to go to school children around the UK.
More brilliant.
Excellent news.
Fantastic publicity for Google.
Yeah. Welcome, Google. Despite abominable reporting by the BBC.
Yeah.
Who quoted someone as saying they felt it was Google trying to lock people into their platform, despite failing to mention that it had nothing to do with Google's platform.
That was terrible, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome news for UK schools. It's great. It's great to see the Raspberry Pi doing so well. And it's Linux.
Yeah.
All these kids learning Linux. It's just really good. I'm genuinely, not cynically, genuinely happy.
It's a facial expression I don't think I've seen on you before.
I know. I'm almost crying. No, that's one too far.
Any other comments on it?
No, I think it's just fantastic. It's fantastic. Splendid. It's fantastic for education.
Splendid for the children of, is it Cherry Hinton Primary School or somewhere near Cambridge, anyway.
Is it just one school that's got 15,000? They've built their new building out of just boxes of these Raspberry Pis.
Yeah, exactly. They've bricked them on purpose by installing something. Yeah.
Do you know anything more about how they're going to be distributed? Or
no, they did put a link. Well, they didn't put a link. They put a message on the website. I think you can apply for them.
Right.
But I don't think there's a formal method. Just if you've got a particular thing, if you're working at a school or whatever, drop Liz an email and say, give us some pies.
Yeah. We need to, I mean, I know lots of people are working on it, but it'd be great when there's some kind of proper decent course material for different age groups so that you can start a class with 6-year-olds, an after school club, and, you know, you've already got everything, all the material at your fingertips, you know, so that anybody could do it effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually something we could do. We could help. Mm. Maybe we should.
Yeah. So, raspberries are one thing you can put in a pie. Beef is another. Spherical Cow is the latest version of Fedora. But the features list for the next version of Fedora has just been announced, and they're dropping MySQL in favour of MariaDB.
Massive news.
Are they are they going to go from Beefy Miracle to Hidden Horse or something?
Finder's Horse.
I was actually just about to look up what the name of Fedora 19 was before I came over, and I didn't get around to it.
I think that's what they should use.
What, Hidden Horse?
Hidden Horse.
You can put it in. They do a really open nomination procedure. There's a wiki. You go and type in what you reckon. And there has to be the criteria. Well, one of the criteria is you have to be able to use the phrase, previous version of Fedora was a blank. Your name is also a blank. So, for example, Beefy Miracle. I think the one for the new one, Spherical Cow, when Beefy Miracle is a Beefy Miracle, Spherical Cow is also a Beefy Miracle. And it has to be, you have to be able to put it in that phrase. So there's always a link going forwards.
Right.
So, whatever.
So when the human race is wiped out and that's the only trace of it is the Fedora names, then everything will make sense.
They'll be able to chain culture backwards through a series of linked names.
All the way back to Charlton Heston on the beach.
But yeah, this is massive news, I guess, primarily because MariaDB is the fork of MySQL by Monty Widenius, the guy who co-founded MySQL right at the very beginning. MySQL was bought by Sun and then by Oracle. Everybody got annoyed by the way what Oracle was doing and whether Oracle had mixed loyalties on the direction MySQL would take. MariaDB was set up by Monty Widenius to kind of provide some balance and give people another option. He told us in an interview just recently, in fact, which we should put online, that it had been a massive loss-making endeavor, really, because Oracle had got so many contracts locked into MySQL, but with Fedora 19 taking on MariaDB, it's going to inevitably mean that enterprise versions of Fedora and probably OpenSUSE in the end will move to MariaDB, which will then mean probably that the contracts will start to go to MariaDB and Monty Widenius' company, which is good for MySQL MariaDB development because it's a much more open direction for the database to take.
Yeah, I mean, Fedora tends to be the distro that does it first. That's their sort of raison d'etre, if you like. They have a bleeding edge distro that is the first one to make the change and it sort of follows through to the others. So this is likely, I think this is quite likely to be a general thing before too long.
Yeah.
So, moving from one fork of an Oracle project to another community fork of an Oracle project, LibreOffice 4.0 just released. Andrew.
Sorry, hey.
Andrew, I know you've been having a look at this.
Yes.
You've been bathing in the new feature glory. So covered are you in new features, you couldn't get in through the door.
my favourite thing about OpenOffice/LibreOffice has always been when you install it, how long it takes and how all the different language packs that you can see flashing up. Yeah. Like Afrikaans, like support for the spell checker and stuff that I don't want, that I will never ever use, but it's just there using up my bandwidth and my hard drive and I resent it slightly. So I don't really want new features and you know, the LibreOffice people don't seem to have given me any new features. So that's great. There's a formula that helps you in the spreadsheet application that helps you calculate how much your stocks are worth. But I tend to do that just with maths.
Google's really good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And some other stuff, no doubt. Oh, the Android thing for the presentations. Didn't you see that in action?
I did see that in action, yeah. It looks quite nifty, although I saw it at a distance. I don't know what it was like up front. But yeah, basically it was Michael Meeks giving a presentation and he just had his phone and he could just swipe sideways. I don't know why I'm giving the demonstration. You can't see it. But he would swipe across the phone and it changed the slides. It was great. Yeah, and the other thing he talked about is obviously as well as the new feature on the front side, they've done a huge amount of work and they're continuing to do a huge amount of work in just making the code base good. It's 20 years old, it's legacy.
But for like, I can't remember for how many years we've said this about every OpenOffice and LibreOffice release, and they've put a lot of effort into making the code good.
Yeah, but it's what, is it 4 million lines of code? I mean, it's a, you know, it's a lot of code.
Every release of Linux of LibreOffice is touted as the fastest LibreOffice ever. You know, we've cleaned up a lot. And what was that, a couple of releases ago?
Yeah,
I think Michael was saying that.
That's Michael Meeks.
Michael. That they put a lot of work into getting rid of unnecessary cruft, such as German language comments.
I mean, what? That's not
that's not low-hanging fruit. That's just stuff to do when you're bored.
This is something Michael talks about in the presentation. It's actually really critical because it's being developed all over the world. I mean, Michael Meeks has just done a world tour introducing it, and this is the thing he's talking about. And he's like, they've got developers in China, they've got developers in Saudi, all over the world, and they just don't know what the code's doing. If you've got a comment in German and you speak Chinese, uh-huh. and you go...
Google Translate. So that's what the rest of us do.
Just add comments in all possible different languages.
No, just they're standardising it in English. As you say, it's not ideal, but there has to be a standard language. English is the most widely spoken language.
Why can't these foreigners just learn German?
After Chinese.
Because it's all about encouraging people to develop the code.
What?
If you say, before you can start working on LibreOffice, you have to know C++, Java, there's some Perl code in there, and German... then basically it would just be Mike developing it by himself.
Then it would be awesome. Then there would be no stupid Afrikaans language pattern.
No, it would be written in assembly and fit into 604K of base RAM. Oh, sorry, wrong Mac.
They've translated over half the comments and they've still got 20,000 lines of comments to go. I mean, it's a huge amount to get through.
That's an awful lot of treading water to do.
Yeah.
Can you just select all and then press delete?
Google Translate.
I mean, they've written a script that goes through the code and automatically recognises German. So yeah, it is still one of the biggest challenges. They're still trying to find German speakers to help them with it. It's the one thing Michael Meek says at every talk. German speakers, come and help. So, yeah, LibreOffice split from Oracle's OpenOffice, and Oracle obviously had a really high-profile court battle with Google last year. Google also produces a browser, Chrome, and Chrome's just... they just demoed a feature of WebRTC with Firefox where you could effectively create a video chat directly between the browsers, sort of a peer-to-peer system, which actually, I don't know if you saw the videos of it, it looks really cool.
It did look cool. I saw the two stories come up on Hacker News. Yeah. I like the one. It was like there were two. One for Chrome to Firefox and one for Firefox to Chrome.
Yeah.
It's neat.
I mean, what the cool thing about the story was for me is that this is obviously pushing the boundaries of HTML5, the new generation of the internet, basically, and they're working on it together. This isn't sort of Firefox's features and Chrome's features. Yeah. This is the web's features, and they both come in and work with it. Which I think is fantastic news for the future of the internet. It would have been nice if Internet Explorer was in there as well, but c'est la vie.
Bad for Internet Explorer in the end.
Yeah. That's obviously bad for Microsoft in the future. Microsoft, incidentally, have been rumoured to be looking into a Linux port for Office in 2014. But to be honest, it seems incredibly thin to me.
Yes, this came from a Pharonix staffer at Fosdem.
Yeah.
Fosdem.
So you were at Fosdem.
I was at Fosdem.
Just last weekend, just or the weekend last before last.
The corridors of power.
I guess, but it seems like a weird thing for Microsoft to do.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I mean, they're even talking about pulling the as yet unreleased iOS and Android versions. I mean, actually... it's obviously the sort of thing that you're looking at with Microsoft. It's always been a big tension. Yeah. Do they sell Office and use Windows to promote it, or do they sell Windows and use Office to promote it? Because if they lock Office to Windows, that's a huge lock-in. But going forwards, if Windows loses market share, then...
Yeah.
Bosh. Whereas if they really push Office across all the platforms, it is, as much as I hate to say it, it is right now the best Office suite out there. At an enterprise level... Yeah.
It's just amazing that I've been able to live my life, you know, for the last 7 or 8 years without it. I just don't know how I get by.
I mean, it's only really needed at an enterprise level. It's so tied into the entire IT infrastructure that companies just can't live without it and aren't likely to be able to for a long time, frankly. If they did produce a Linux version, it would make it much more attractive to...
enterprises.
Enterprise desktop use.
Yeah. But it would also make LibreOffice and OpenOffice a lot less attractive for home users.
Yeah. We should point out that you can actually run Office on Windows, on Linux. So there's a number of ways to do it. You can use web-based, you can use Wine, or you can
crossover.
Yeah, crossover.
Play on Linux, virtual machine.
No. What am I talking about? Pac-Man. Like a VNC type thing where you run it basically.
Oh yes, yeah.
Yeah, and you can even rent versions for short periods of time if you want to. So there's loads of ways of doing it. Yeah, it's making big news on the internet, but to be honest, it looks pretty spurious to me.
There was another interesting thing that came from FOSDEM that I read that it's kind of related to this, that a Wine developer employed by Codeweavers who make Crossover is working on an Android port of Wine.
Yeah, I saw that.
The interesting thing, I think, is that surely that finally makes Wine a real emulator. Because surely they're going to have to emulate the x86 code.
Well, no, because are they just going to run Windows RT stuff?
Well, no, I'd assumed they were going to make it was going to run Windows apps.
Yeah, but compiled for Windows RT.
It is an emulator, come on.
Well, I'd assumed it would be legacy Windows apps.
Yeah.
Which finally makes Wine an emulator. Do they have to call it Y? Discoveries of things. There's always an awkward pause here when I don't know what to do or whether I should ask someone else whether they go first. Does anyone want to go first?
I'll go first.
Excellent.
I don't so much have a discovery as a list of stuff I learnt this week. But I'll start.
That's cool.
I'll start from the bottom of my list just to break convention. Been chatting to quite a few developers of new mobile systems. Chat to the guys at Yola, which I've now learnt how to pronounce is Yola, not Jolla or Holla.
Yola.
Chat to a guy from Firefox OS, and we've been in contact with the guys from Ubuntu. And there seems to be some weird sort of spider's web of app compatibility. For example, Sailfish will run Android apps, obviously, as will Android. Sailfish and Ubuntu will both run Quickly apps. And Ubuntu and Firefox will both treat web apps natively. So my discovery is that there's going to be some horrible tangled web of app compatibility looming in the future.
That's a mess, isn't it? Considering this, they're all kind of so related in lots of many ways.
Yeah.
Have to wait and see.
I mean, to be honest, I can only see it going towards web apps. I mean, HTML5 is so... I mean, it's getting so powerful now. And it'd be... I imagine Sailfish is going to be using the Firefox browser. I don't know that for sure. So if they do, it'd be relatively easy for them to treat web apps, you know, give them the same priority within things as native apps. And Android, Google are looking to support Firefox's web app infrastructure on ChromeOS, so they may well be doing it for Android as well. But yeah, there's going to be a looming spider's web of nastiness there.
So whoever does it the simplest and the most transparently way will win.
Yeah. And I think Firefox have a big thing that they're not targeting their own platform. They're targeting an idea that will run on all platforms, including theirs, which I think will be their big win. So, another miscellaneous selection of things I've discovered. 64 gigabyte micro SD cards are worth more than twice their weight in gold.
Cool.
Say that again.
64 gigabit micro SD cards are worth more than twice their weight in gold.
Cool.
At current market prices.
Right. And if you put a load of pirated movies on there, then they're worth even more.
True.
Which the MPAA will then try and claim back through the British courts.
Is this because of the Thailand floods, or was that just spinny hard drives?
I think that was spinny hard drives, because I think SSD prices are still coming down, aren't they?
Yeah. I don't know, to be honest. I think microSD cards have always been fairly expensive and very light.
Right. So.
This one is related. The bandwidth of FedEx's entire fleet carrying just micro SD cards would be equivalent to 177 petabits per second, roughly 1,000 times more than the current internet capacity.
That's amazing. That's awesome. That really is amazing.
And if these facts don't sound familiar to you, you obviously don't read What If XKCD.com, in which case you should. It's awesome. what-if.xkcd.com.
I wonder how that works out at cost per terabyte or something like that, because obviously FedEx is going to be a lot more money.
Not when you get to the high amounts, I wouldn't have thought. I don't know. Yeah, move on to an entirely unrelated topic. You can build an entire cannon out of gaffer tape and it will fire.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, they did that on Mythbusters. It was awesome. Just gaffer tape.
More ideas for extremists.
Like a what proper big cannon.
Yeah.
If you didn't know.
What do you use to kind of, as the ignition
source? Oh, they use gunpowder.
Right. Well, you can put gunpowder in any old tube, I guess, and fire something.
To be honest, most of them will just explode.
Yeah.
You need to put it into a reasonably solid tube to make a cannon.
Yeah.
It didn't go as far as when they used their actual cannon with the same amount of gunpowder and the same cannonball. But
I remember one where they made a cannon out of a single hollowed out tree.
Ah, I didn't see that.
And they think they had to wrap some iron bands around it. But it was because of a legend of somewhere in Bosnia or the Czech Republic or somewhere where the villagers hid behind their walls and hollowed out a tree and made a cannon to scare off the Turks.
Did it work?
Well, did it work in the legend or
in real life?
Yeah, it did. But again, didn't throw the ball very far.
Oh no, it threw it like 300 yards. It's just the regular cannon threw it like 800 yards. So I mean, it was a cannon.
It's worth bearing in mind forever stuck in the storage room. Yeah. With some dynamite.
Linux format, the A-Team edition.
I know, I'm stuck. Ben's there. Oh no, we're trapped in the storage room with nothing but gaffer tape.
I can see him at the back of the room just chucking things out of the way. Looking for the gaffer tape. We saved
nothing but a Range Rover and an oxyacetylene welding torch and a whole load of scrap metal. What are we going to do? Yeah. Oh, it's alright, lads, I found some gaffer tape.
On more tape related discoveries. I haven't done much work this week. I've learned the gaffer tape, duct tape and duct tape are different things.
Really, what is the difference? This is amazing.
Yeah. Duct tape is the original name for waterproof adhesive tape with that weird cottony inline thing. Yeah. And it comes from duct cloth, which was used in shoemaking beforehand. That's the sort of cotton stuff they impregnate. And it was used in the Second World War to seal ammo cartridges, and it was sort of an olive green. Later, someone after the war, some commercial enterprise started making it silver to blend in with the colour of ducts, air ducts, and duct tape was born. Gaffer tape is similar, but it's not permanent, so it's designed not to leave a sticky residue. So gaffer tape you can stick on and remove, and now duct tape is currently a brand name of duct tape, despite duct tape previously being an overarching term for duct tape and all tape with a cotton inlay.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben.
That's my random list of discoveries.
Awesome. A few months ago, I discovered that if your landlord is rubbish and hasn't bothered to grout the tiles properly in the bathroom of your grade 2 listed flat, you can just stick non-brand specific plumber's tape on the cracks between the tiles and it works perfectly.
Yeah.
So, if you're a lame ass, you don't fancy doing DIY properly, why not give that a go?
Awesome.
Great. Anyone else?
Yeah, I got one. I recently went to Mexico and I flew in United Airlines and I realized entertainment.
Wonderful airline.
It's just brilliant.
The staff, especially the staff.
I just like, oh my god! And also, if you're traveling from the States, from any city in the States to Mexico, even if it's a 5-hour flight, they charge you for your food.
Yeah.
Come on, like you didn't pay for that in the price of your ticket. Come on, honestly, that wasn't the discovery.
Sorry, it's my fault.
But no, that's right. Thanks for
crying into my
allowing
beer
me to discharge my anger. the entertainment in-flight entertainment system. Normally, when you board a plane, it's turned off, and then they turn it on as soon as the last passenger sits on the
telescreens.
Yeah, and no, the proper one, the ones. the ones that have a box underneath the seat, and you have a little screen in front of you.
It's funny. It's running
Linux anyway, and I'm not sure whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but the subject of to these 2 minutes of looking at the codes when they turn it on, and when they boot the system, and you know, Linux with Stuxes around the corner, the top corner of the screen, but although it seemed to be like a modern graphical interface on it, it's still really clunky, especially when you use the volume buttons. They just don't, it's touch screen, but it just doesn't seem to work. And people just basically give up on it and get their tablets or the mobile phones or the laptops to watch their own films or to listen to their own music.
Bring your own device.
Exactly. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if everything is like more like Android, that rather than using an operating system like any, I don't know, Linux properly based entertainment system. And there is. last July in 2012, Qatar Airlines, they're implementing on the new super duper airlines, the Boeing 787, a new Android in-flight entertainment system, which is faster, more reliable and stable, and so on and so on. And now all the companies like
BA. Next time I fly to Qatar,
but now
I'm
BA,
not gonna go United.
But now BA is doing it, so that's good news for me, because they're gonna implement it on the transatlantic flights.
Hasn't the 787s
burst into flames?
I don't know.
They're all being grounded because of a problem with the batteries.
But at least they had a really good in-flight entertainment system
before they burned.
Well, there you go.
It's quite fun. It's fire. You just can't help but stare at the flames.
So it's not a new discovery. That's what I was saying. But it was thought to use Android for the in-flight entertainment system. That was that. Thank you very much.
Cool.
Also, Chromium stopped. Flash stopped working on my Chromium installation on my Mint Linux box. Why? What does that happen? I had to reinstall it again. I discovered I had to reinstall it again using the software center. Why?
Maybe this is a future's IT people sneaking in to disable it to stop you watching YouTube.
It wasn't my house. It wasn't my house. So I don't think that happened because I lock it.
I didn't think you needed to lock your doors in the 1950s idyll where you lived.
It's a nice community. I know I should be safe.
Yeah, but you can't take laptops through the back of the wardrobe.
Yep. Anyway.
Anyway, Effie's... hang on. Sorry. Did you have a discovery?
Yeah, I have, actually. Shall I go next?
You might as well.
I've got a couple of small discoveries. One is that I discovered you can host a web page from Google Docs. So if you actually write an index.html, for example, and then right-click it and share it, you can share it as a web page and you get a URL, and everybody can kind of access that. You can even stick JavaScript in there, apparently. The other thing is that I like emulators, and I've only just discovered PCSX2, which is a PlayStation 2 emulator for Linux. Version 1.0 was released in August, and 1.01 or 1.1 was released in December. I haven't tried it yet, and obviously this is legally vague. You need to legally get hold of the BIOS from a PlayStation 2, and you need to legally own the games that you run on it. But from what I can see on the YouTube videos of it in action, it runs PlayStation 2 games, if you've got a decent machine, 100%. And there's also upscaling for all those PS2 games as well, so they're running at 1080p. And it's brilliant, because there are some brilliant PlayStation 2 games that I just can't play anymore, because my PS2, the drive doesn't work.
Oh, PS2s, they're the ones that use the weird black discs. Is that PS2?
Yeah, the blue discs.
Yeah, do they run on a... Can you whack that into your drive?
Yeah, they are just normal normal optical media. So it'll... I have to try it, so I'll report back on how it works. If I can get SSX3, which is all I want.
So there are DVDs, PS2, PS2 games.
Yeah, they're normal DVDs. And CDs, and they all look the same. Yeah. Some of the older titles are just CDs. They're my discoveries. Anything, Andrew? No?
Not really.
That's fine. We're already 52 minutes in. Yeah.
52 minutes in.
I know you've actually got something.
Discover it.
Cool, then that's our discoveries of the week. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
That shocking revelation that we are already 52 minutes into recording the podcast brings us to our long overdue halfway reminder.
Still to come, we have a section resurrected from the grave in the form of our challenges section. And we also have an open ballot.
Excellent.
Which brings us on to the resurrected challenges section.
Should I do the resurrected challenges section?
Yeah, because I don't think you've been talking enough in this podcast.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Resurrecting the challenges section from a time before when I joined. This is my very first challenges section.
Oh, you'll love
it. Oh, he's so young. He'll learn.
Yeah, I haven't learned to despise it like the other people.
This was always a great section. We loved the idea of it, and we did some brilliant things. We wrote games, and we did music, and we drew penguins. It's just we got very bad at it. So, yeah.
So, we thought we'd start ourselves off, ease ourselves into it with a relatively easy one. So, what we've decided to do for this... for this Fortnite's challenge is to switch distros. So as it currently stands, Graham uses Arch, I use Ubuntu, Andrew uses Mint Debian Edition.
Yeah.
Is that right? And F uses Mint Mate 12. Cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
So we're gonna rotate. So Andrew's gonna take Arch, Graham's gonna take Mint, Effie's gonna take Ubuntu, and I'm gonna take Mint Debian Edition.
So I'm regular Mint Cinnamon then?
Mint Cinnamon.
Yeah. Mint Cinnamon.
Okay.
And we shall report back to you in a fortnight's time.
So are we using these exclusively for the next 2 weeks? And we've got to get some work done as well. I mean, it's all right for me with Mint, but I'm just thinking of Andrew installing Arch. Will we get news?
If part of the magazine's handwritten this month.
It's okay though, because we can fill in the pages that I would have written with a load of Samsung advertising Samsung advertising tat instead.
Excellent. It feels good to have this section back. So I'll install Mint.
Is this the latest version of Ubuntu then?
I'm actually using 12.04 at the moment, so because I don't want my search results stolen.
Oh, okay, that's what I was thinking. I'm gonna have to tweak all that stuff.
That is a problem with Ubuntu, isn't it?
It is a problem with Ubuntu.
You know what would be great?
Would it be if someone released a remixed version of Ubuntu that respected your privacy?
That would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, who could do such a thing, Ben?
Who?
I don't know.
There'd have to be someone really awesome.
Someone really elite. Someone who's good at remixing Linux distributions.
Clever. Very clever.
I've still got Mike's number. That awkward silence brings us to the open ballot. Yeah, that would be awesome. What could we call it? We could call it the Ubuntu Ben is awesome. Ben respects your freedom more than Ubuntu does. Unless Canonical's HR people get back to me. Then we'll call it the rubbish version of Ubuntu that's not as good as the one that steals, borrows your data. So, open ballot. What's been the best thing to happen to Linux in the last millennium? And by millennium, we mean 1,000 years. Or do we mean 999 years? Or do we just mean 13 years since the year 2000? I don't know. Like Fortnite.
I've been to the year 3000.
Do they all live underwater? So, back to boy band school for you, Graham. Anybody, what was their...
You know something? I've been busy. I haven't given it any thought. It seemed like a great question, and I meant to, think about it on the cycle ride into work. There's been so many really good things. I mean, yeah, I know the Raspberry Pi was mentioned in the intro text, and there's just too much good stuff. Almost everything is a positive development. SCO being defeated.
Well, such is the nature of this. We didn't ask a yes or no question. It was all very, quite open-ended. And so most people, or rather one of the common threads that people have dragged up from the depths of the ocean, is that their best Linux moment of the millennium was when they started using Linux. Or, yeah. I mean, look at this. Jerubi says, "For me, the greatest Linux moment was when I, fiddling around with Slackware 13 on my laptop, discovered that this operating system puts me in control of everything about my computer. Seriously, you can customize the frequency of your CPU beep."
What?
Really? Anyway. And lots like that, but a bit less geeky. Morten Yule Johansson Zoldefeyer says, "I cannot determine the date, but for me personally, it was the day I stopped dual booting and wiped my Windows installation with Mandrake 10. Because I decided the system was solid and broad enough to cover my computing needs." Mandrake 10, when would that have been?
Probably early in the decade.
Sorry.
Yeah, probably just...
More than 10 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I can't remember. I remember that when I started using Mandrake, it was version 7, and that was about 1999, 2000.
Wow. Mandrake was the first Linux that I ever installed.
Yeah,
I couldn't get it to work properly. I had to get you to fix it for me.
Mine was SUSE, and I couldn't work out how to install software on it. Kept looking for exe files, and there weren't any.
Oh. Yeah, or downloading stuff from the internet and just trying to get it to run.
Yeah,
but then if you had trouble installing Mandrake, wait till you try Arch next week.
But the first distro I used was Ubuntu, on just I had the same sort of sensation, just changed my life completely. Yeah. And it was easy to use, easy as hell.
Once you get used to it, it's like in my house, you know, the router's got a hacked version of Linux on it, my FreeSat TV box has got a hacked version of Linux on it, my NAS box has got a hacked version of Linux on it, you know, my phone or whatever. It's just, you get used to this idea that you own the hardware, you can do what you want with it.
Mm.
Yeah, Rodville says, "The greatest day was the day I ditched Windows for Linux. My life has never been the same since then." Hjauj says, "Hi Hjauj, for me it was LXF issue 100, my first ever issue."
Wow.
And the one that
the
got
new
me...
The New Horizons.
Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Of course, that was when I wasn't working on the magazine. That was in the interregnum, when the days were dark.
That was a cover clinic cover, that one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's brilliant.
My first ever issue, and the one that got me into Linux for the first time, I bought it because it came with Ubuntu. Yeah. This was in the days when we used to be able to put Ubuntu on the cover disc and know that we'd sell more magazines. However, for the public at large, I think the finest moment in Linux since 2000 was last year when the Raspberry Pi became more desirable than Windows 8.
I think it's in our minds at the moment, so it's difficult to get the immense success of the Raspberry Pi out of them. I know there have been lots of... I mean, Firefox, that was great. OpenOffice, LibreOffice. When you could start to say to people, you know, you can install a free alternative. Don't worry, it's free. Yeah, it's free. You just download it. Is it illegal for me to download? No, just do it.
See, but I can say the same about the whole thing about Android. And Android is just a brilliant thing. It's just so free and so accessible. You don't have to be tied to anything. And you can take it wherever you want. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, most of us care about, you know, freedom of expression.
Yeah.
And if we're in a world without Linux, it would be a world run by Apple and Microsoft. And I'm not criticizing what they do, but what they do is restrict what you're allowed to do with your hardware. And just from Linux, just being there, providing an alternative, you can install a deep package on Android or whatever it is you want to do.
Mm.
It just makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember, you know, you're talking about Firefox. It was just before Firefox was released, when Internet Explorer was right on the edge of having just complete control over the internet. It had like 90%
All banks were using it.
Yeah. And it was that thing, that was when there's slightly different versions of HTML, and you saw this site only looks good in Internet Explorer, all that. And it really looked like suddenly you weren't going to be able to use the web if you didn't use Internet Explorer.
And Windows,
yeah. And then suddenly Firefox came along, it gained market share. It didn't gain that much initially, but it gained enough to stop it being a Microsoft monopoly.
And like the Raspberry Pi, it caught people's imaginations. I mean, those were dark days. I remember, in fact, the Linux desktop was crippled by a closed web. You know, you couldn't do a lot of things that you needed to do, like buy things online.
Yeah.
You know, but we were using it, because I wasn't using Linux a lot of time. And I remember the days where Internet Explorer basically wasn't every single machine, but we were using Macs, and Netscape Navigator was sort of the browser for the rebels, and it just never worked. It never worked properly, and I was really glad when Firefox came out. It was brilliant.
Yeah. We had Netscape, but yeah. Simon says, Mozilla Firefox showed me, and I imagine millions of others, that the most used piece of software on a computer could run on other platforms with exactly the same functionality. Showed millions that moving platforms was viable. That's moving between platforms.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. The Ubuntu's come in for a lot of stick for having a user interface that's kind of touch based, and so when you say, you know, don't use Windows 8 like our latest magazine does, use Linux, and then people say, yeah, but Unity's got some of the same problems. It's with Linux, you do have the choice. It's a bit like breakfast cereal.
The greatest moment for Linux this millennium, Saif Ahmed says, was when Stephen Ballmer described Linux as a cancer that attaches itself in an intellectual property sense to everything it touches. In an interview on May 31st, 2001, the cancer that liberates has since cured me and millions of others of Windows completely. Along may it continue to metastasize.
It's been years since I did biology.
Sounds about right, anyway. Yes, and Organic Rodent agrees, any day that Mr. B opens his mouth to enthuse about Microsoft products. Seriously, though, the day, this is the best day, has yet to come.
Yes.
When organisations and education institutions stop swallowing the FUD spread by others about open source software and hype about Windows OS 10, when kids are once again shown how to program, thanks to the largesse of Google, I inserted that, imagine the square brackets around that phrase, and use any computer, not just those running Windows or, in the posher schools, OS 10.
That is a posh school.
That's a really posh school. Well, I think, yes, indeed. In the last millennium, I think 1066 was good for, was good for Linux.
For English cuisine.
Yeah. 1588 was all right. Oh, that stopped us being controlled by the Spanish. That was it, to be honest. I was about to move on and ask you what you thought your best millennial Linux moment was, apart from Cliff Richard's Millennium Prayer.
That must have been the last, before 10 years ago.
It was
more than longer than 10 years ago. Yeah.
But then
it could have released it after the millennium.
we reckon, like, names are misleading, aren't they? I mean, yeah. Princess 1999 didn't come out in 1999.
Yeah, true.
George Orwell's 1984 didn't come out in 1984. But it is going to be on Radio 4 this Sunday.
Is it?
Yeah, there's an adaptation on for Radio Play.
Oh, I might have to record
it. I think Christopher Eccleston's going to be Winston Smith.
I actually just read it for the first time about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. What did you think to it?
I didn't really like the way it ended. It just sort of faded out.
Don't tell me, because I'm reading it right now.
The smell of the victory gin.
Yeah. And in general, it was really well written, and it was. I enjoyed it.
Well, moving back to me, I think my favourite Linux bit was when I worked out that, because I'm not really into early adoption and stuff and technology. It's just a means to an end, really. Was that I was dual booting SUSE and Windows, and there was just Windows just wouldn't work. It wouldn't get the internet. And rather than fix it, I just thought, well, I can't be bothered. So I just switched over to Linux full time. I think the path of least resistance is attractive to most people. And Linux is, you know, Linux is, well, until UEFI, certainly, it was more or less getting there. Mm. So I think the dangerous dark times are ahead.
I think for me, just having thought about it just a little bit, I like it when we're able to advocate the use of free software. And I suppose it ties in with a question, but Linus Torvalds winning the Millennium Prize, As a kind of a global recognition of his contribution, the fact that this is free software that is making such a huge difference. You know, I think that was a great moment, not that long ago, but just a great moment for Linux and free software and for Linus.
Yeah, because he shared it with somebody who was just epically cool. Yeah. Had adult stem cells.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody who was saving lives, or whose research will go on to save lives. And it put it in context, just how important what Linus started, what people like Richard Stallman, you know, started, this whole movement is having such a positive effect.
For me, I'll do my personal moment of the millennium. It was when it had been early 2000, 2002, 2003, something like that, and I'd been using Linux for a couple of years and on a homemade computer, and the hard drive's fried. I was like, oh man, hard drive's fried, I can't do anything. And I was like, well, actually, I can. You know, I can boot off a live CD and I can use the USB port, USB memory stick thing. And that was the first time I realized just how flexible the system is. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, install it, run, if you want to change things around, remix it up, you can do all that. And that power's there because it's open source. You can't do that on Windows because no one's been able to add that feature. If Microsoft say they don't want you to do it, you can't do it. On Linux, at the time, it was, I think there was only a couple that could boot live, and Nopix and Demo Linux, I think. It's really opened my eyes at just how powerful it was. For Linux as a general thing, one that is quite recent, over the Christmas holidays, the top-selling laptop on Amazon was a Linux-based laptop, was the Chromebook. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those big things. Suddenly, wow, it's actually, you know, it's not a niche product anymore. It's,
yeah. Yeah. When you say Linux in public, people don't go, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. When I started here, I sort of chatting to a lot of people, you know, just generally, oh, you know, where do you work? Oh, I've just started working with Linux format. Everyone had heard of Linux. They didn't necessarily know what it was in detail, but they knew, oh, that's that computer thing.
Yeah, yeah.
See, I think that is mine. The fact that before I was using Mac OS and doing graphic design, all the tools are there ready for you. You just use them. You learn the tool and then you do your job. But installing Ubuntu was a revelation, because suddenly I found myself in an environment which I wasn't aware of, I didn't understand, and gradually just realizing that it wasn't actually that difficult to see what the components were, the different parts of the system was, and sort of managing them as well. So it gives you an enormous sense of satisfaction being a non-technical person. It was just brilliant. It was just a brilliant thing. Then making the decision, well, I don't need anything else. That's it. I just use this. Okay, I have to do my job in a different platform, but for my computing needs and purposes, I just use that.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant. It's a brilliant thing. Liberating. And then realizing that my kids didn't even need any introduction to the system. They just give them a computer with Linux in it and then just use it naturally. So it was great.
Cool. Yeah. That about wraps it up.
That is pretty cool.
I thought, like, is that the end of open ballot?
That is the end of the open ballot. The open ballot is now closed.
I thought, like, because people wanted a one last thing, that I'd just dig up old tips of the month that we find cool.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a tip of the month here from Christmas issue. No, issue 152. And it's pretty cool, actually. So, if you want to create a simple web server and you've got Python installed, it's python-m simple HTTP server, and then I guess the port name.
Yeah, it's actually quite useful if you're penetration testing something, because if you need to get documents off something, and you can just run a single command, run that, and you can browse.
Excellent. So as long as they've got Python installed, you've got a web server at your fingertips.
Yeah.
And that's the tip. And that's it for episode 2. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.
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 Like you say, I